Friends, when one has lived a long life as a member of the TS, one has also lived through certain phases that have taken place during that society's existence. In my younger days, Mrs. Besant and C.W. Leadbeater were still alive and vigorously active, so that the masters were much in the foreground and their presence distinctly sensed in whatever work took place. When, however, I had reached middle age, and by that time Sri Ram was international president, a change had made itself felt. We were advised not to pester the masters with too much attention, as it interfered with their work. And in a certain piece of work in which I happened to be involved, a letter from Sri Ram was read to all of us that caused a considerable shock, for it seemed to remove the master's hitherto rather specialized interest in it and leave the workers with a feeling of abandonment. Other groups with no affiliation to the TS began to publish books, hinting that the masters were no longer resident in Tibet. One group asserting that they had moved to South America, exchanging remote spots in the Himalayas for equally remote spots in the Andes. One such book categorically stated that theosophists had better realize that the masters were no longer backing their movement, having withdrawn from it. At about this period, Krishnamurti's talks were raising doubts in some minds as to the master's existence, though if you read through his books, you will find no evidence that he endorsed this view, but was only asking us why we thought we needed them. In support of this assertion, I might mention that Miss Clara Codd, a famous and much loved international lecturer, some of you may remember, once told a small group of her friends that when at Adyar, she once had the opportunity of asking him if he believed in the masters. Krishnamurti did not answer her question, but merely posed another, which was a little habit of his, saying, "Oh, Clara, does it really matter?" Miss Codd then added, "But I saw by his eyes that he did." And she was a person of vast experience and sharp perspicuity. However this may be, his talks did raise doubts, so that added to the then general policy of soft peddling allusions to the masters, I sensed an atmosphere of embarrassment when mentioning them in general theosophical conversations, as one would if God were mentioned at a dinner party. Being no better than anyone else, I followed the trend, never giving talks on them and rarely calling attention to them except in passing. Becoming acquainted with Geoffrey Hodgson's account of his life's work has changed all that for me. The masters have become more real than they ever did before, and I expect it has had the same effect on others of its readers too. One can intuit that Geoffrey had great hopes that this would happen, which is why he asked Sandra, his wife, to publish excerpts from his diary after he had departed this life. An unnamed adept adds, "One part of the great value of the diary is that it demonstrates that although publicly closed, the occult life and tradition of the planet continues." The Master Moria suggests that the diary will be like a continuation of the Mahatma letters and will greatly validate all that which has already been revealed. This will be very helpful, hence the idea. The last phrase, "hence the idea," seems to hint that the idea of the diary was not Geoffrey's or Sandra's, but the Master's. As we know, we can pick up the ideas that the Masters spread on their meditations and even think such ideas are our own. Now, much of what I have to say will be well known to you. And this being a members-only talk, you have every right to assume that I'm treating you like a beginner's class. But please, listen to my reason for daring to sit here and lecture you on this subject. You must have noticed that when the Masters are mentioned seriously and with intent, a rather special atmosphere becomes apparent. It was Jesus who said, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them." Did you notice that no place was mentioned here? The gathering can be in a church, in a hall like this, in a Masonic lodge, in a private lounge, or in the open air. There is not even the restriction of a specific religion or any religion at all. So long as the gathering is in his name, his presence is guaranteed. It seems to be like this, not only with the Masters with whom we are acquainted, but other adepts can also make use of the opportunity to spread the great forces that course through the universe. Geoffrey mentions occasional visits, for example, of an adept whose name we are never told. Sandra records only the words "unnamed adept." There is the proviso, however, that more than one person is involved, and the meeting is in the name of a being who has the right to respond in the manner described. These strictures, though, are only apparent, being really safeguards against a premature assumption of power before an individual is sufficiently prepared to receive its impact. Because no special places or people are mentioned, It also follows that the presence of the Master, under whose aegis the gathering is held, is not inhibited by any particular creed or belief of those composing it. The Masters indeed have the amazing power to draw good out of what may look to us like unpromising materials. Now, I am certainly not suggesting that we here are unpromising materials. Quite the reverse, in fact. But we are certainly assembled in this hall, and we are definitely more than two or three, I'm glad to see, and we are gathered together in the name of the Masters. Since it is that subject that has drawn you here, and though nothing I may say may be new to you, their wonderful influence will permeate this group, and with our help, the whole of our present environment. If you have looked at the lodge program, you will have seen that a short mention has been made of the source of my talk. In it occurs the full title of Jeffrey's posthumous publication, the book I have been quoting, Light of the Sanctuary. Not until I had read it did I realize the colossal amount of work the author of it did during his long life of nearly 97 years. I never guessed before then that so much of his lecturing and writing was accomplished at the request of the adepts with whom he was in communication, often too with their direct help. At this juncture, it is important to know how these communications were effected, since precautions have to be taken to counteract any supposition that Jeffrey was some kind of spiritualist under control. I'm going into this subject because it is useful, as I myself have found, for members to have this knowledge at their fingertips when inquirers or critics raise this question. It would, for example, have been helpful to the member who at one of Krishnamurti's talks asked him a question that concerned the validity of HPB's teachings. He answered that he did not know them. But anyhow, how did she differ from any ordinary medium? How did she differ from any ordinary medium? This brought me up with a jerk, because it was an honest criticism, and I should know how to answer it without having to pause while I worked it out. It not only affects HPB, but AB, CWL, and of course Jeffrey Hodgson, whom we are now considering. Jeffrey naturally would have been able to answer it at once, but it is Sandra who in the occult diary makes this abundantly clear, namely by listing in one of her rare interpolations the three types of communication available. And they are: one, totally unconscious, which is trance mediumship. Two, semi-conscious, which is ordinary mediumship. Three, fully conscious reported conversation. for which she revives the ancient word sibylship. The method used by Geoffrey was the same as that employed by the others I have quoted. That is the third type. Sandra goes on to describe it as being made to the higher and lower minds of the recipient, who is completely awake and conscious, knowing full well the process that is taking place, and quite deliberately participating in it. To this she adds, Geoffrey, aided by his adept collaborator, egoically arrives at an understanding of the thought stream, or rather enters an illuminated state, and aided when necessary, translates the ideas into the best English at his disposal at the time in his formal mind, and verbally dictates them to his personal recorder. Well, Sandra was his only personal recorder in these matters, and thus played a most important part in her husband's working life. It was certainly regarded in this light by the adept helpers. At some time in 1977, she was awarded a message entirely to herself, in which occur the following words. The actual language in which Geoffrey receives my teachings is only the vehicle which I give him out of his body when we talk over all these things and sometimes look up the Akashic records. To clinch the matter, she states, Geoffrey is in such complete control of body and mind as to be able without difficulty to clarify or repeat any statement which to the recorder may seem unclear, rephrasing it if necessary. He is able even to inquire of the occult informant whether the new phrasing meets with his approval or not, or to require restatement or enlargement. Do you now see the importance of this knowledge? Its importance is due to the fact that so much of the vital information we are in duty bound to hand on has arrived by the third method, the method of fully reported conversation, conscious. One can therefore see that Sandra witnessed firsthand these teachings more as a dialogue between teacher and student than as a continuous, unrelieved monologue, as would have been the case with the spiritualist control. This occult diary has been of great interest to me, as it has disclosed how an investigator in the subtler realms of matter can be assisted by his more highly developed teachers, and that applies even to HPB herself. Sometimes it is a deva who helps. Geoffrey had his Bethelda, and CWL reports in his introduction to the new colony description in Man, Whence, How and Whither, how these all developed from the intensive examination of a thought form given to him by a passing deva when this being wished to provide an illustration for a lecture CWL was giving at the time. To be like Geoffrey and the others who attained such an intimate relationship with the masters obviously necessitates a certain attitude of the human towards the superhuman. One can call it respect, reverence, or even awe, since it is not a usual relationship at the present time, nor was it in the recent past. Leadbeater describes his own attitude in one of his writings, I think it's The Masters and the Path, in the following little reminder to aspirants and at the same time to himself. I must remember that the honor of the Brotherhood is in my hands, and I must see to it that no word or act of mine shall ever sully it in the eyes of man, or cause him to think of it one whit less highly. Notice, or cause them to think of it one whit less highly. From the same source, a master is quoted as commending an aspirant to this wonderful relationship because he is easy to guide and eager to learn. Remember that. Easy to guide and eager to learn. This genuinely appreciative attitude to a relationship valued at its true worth was reinforced by, again, Clara Codd when she warned us how it could be ruptured by wrong treatment. She was telling us how a very promising theosophist fell short in this respect and in the end left the society altogether. She said, I could see it coming when he started to refer to the masters lightly. Remember C.W.L.'s remark? Cause them to think of it, that is the honor of the masters, one whit less highly. And we have all been told how Hume and Sinnett had to be dropped when they stubbornly failed to recognize the real status of the masters and their functions in a mature way, even causing these great ones to interpolate remarks that plainly referred to these two European gentlemen's class consciousness, racialism, and drinking habits. Sinnett, for example, was constantly asking for a closer and more direct relationship with the masters. But he had to be told that as things were, it was not possible. The master Kuthumi hinted at the reason for it when he precipitated in one of his letters that he would do what he could, adding, if sherry bar not the way. People who merit a mild rebuke like this are really saying to a master, I want a closer relationship with you, but I have no intention of giving up anything of my present lifestyle to do it. The masters have distinctly told us that if we wish to enjoy a relationship with them, we must come out of our world into theirs. This is why such a relationship must bring about a complete reversal of so many of our earthly attitudes and customs. It is here that I find Krishnamurti's teachings so helpful, as he seems to be talking along such lines, though of course in a different context. Certainly this is an important part of the training, the necessity of which forms a thread that continuously runs through Jeffrey's book. It is only when we study these matters deeply that we begin to see the true scope of the Sermon on the Mount and start to doubt that it is a counsel only for saints and does not really apply to human beings like you and me who have, well, what shall I say, certain aspirations. As I select from the occult diary samples of the training that constitutes the path, as I propose to do next, it becomes ever more obvious that the discipline it inculcates is yet another guarantee that what the author records has nothing whatever to do with passively sitting for development, as the spiritualists call it. What follows, Jeffrey narrates as dictated to him by the master Moria. This master, as a co-founder of the Theosophical Society, has become anxious about its future. Inasmuch as in early 1980, he said, a kind of wave is passing over the parent Theosophical Society, producing the accentuation of openness to other movements and other teachings, and a general tendency to maintain a very wide landscape of thought throughout the movement. Whilst these have their values when rightly understood, they are also potentially harmful to the movement, dangerous indeed. He then referred to the teachings as originally given, adding, whilst all aspects of theosophy are most desirably to be presented, popularized indeed, these more deeply intellectual, spiritual, and philosophical ideas should not be allowed to sink into the background, as they are now in danger of doing. 1980. The points the master emphasized refer to the path, which when trodden leads straight to the Great White Brotherhood, members of which have voluntarily forfeited Nirvana to undertake the assisting of humanity. What is to be understood as the original teachings, but the deeper ones, according to the Master Moria, appear to include particularly those concerning the masters and the path. These are as follows. The possibility of knowing the theosophical teachings directly, for which purpose every human being has certain powers, now latent, but able to be aroused. This may be done safely, since a group of adepts exists, some of whom have made themselves available to those aspirants who genuinely seek to tread this path of hastened evolution, the qualifications being selflessness, self-control. This may be done safely, since a group of adepts exists, some of whom have made themselves available to those aspirants who genuinely seek to tread this path of hastened evolution, the qualifications being selflessness, self-control, an open heart, and a willingness to serve. From the moment a human being has that spirit awakened, an adept watches, waiting for the time when the path of discipleship may be consciously, and I repeat, consciously, entered upon. That master then gives the necessary training during sleep. But after a certain stage is reached, actual meetings, generally superphysical, can take place. The goal to be reached is adeptship. Now I have noticed that Jeffrey, in all his writings, is careful to preserve the balance between aids and obstacles. So it is the honorable thing for me, as his humble admirer, to do the same when dealing with the path as described in the occult diary. The way to the masters means indeed extremely hard work. For in offering oneself for it, one has to sacrifice quite a lot and face up to tests that require stability and fortitude of a high order. We are, as it were, laboring out of season. Since we have ceased to be drifters and are hastening our evolution in advance of our time. The members of the Brotherhood who instigated this society, as well as those who supported and still support it, are hoping that they will, through what it has to give us, obtain recruits for their ranks. As Jeffrey's special instructor, the Master Polydorus, remarks, the Brotherhood is seeking disciples. In occultism, however, one must learn to take rebuffs, disappointments, and pain. They are, please note, created by our own littleness and the errors which arise from it. They are our own fault and no one else's. Beware of looking for consolation and sympathy in these conditions, for that would indicate weakness. We should be absolute indifferent as regards oneself, but never as regard the cares, sorrows, and burdens of others. Difficult or awkward situations will arise because we will be deliberately led into their vicinity. Since we must be thoroughly tested, and he who watches will observe how we cope with them, as aspirants have to learn to master every situation. One of these situations is the question of diet, but I need not go into that any further after the illustration of Mr. Sinnett, beyond mentioning that the awkwardness consists generally of when we leave our home and depend on others for our meals. Another important point is being able to still the mind so that one can listen. Jeffrey advocates a special part of one's meditation being devoted to this. As usually, the mind creates such a din of chattering that the still small voice of the monad cannot be heard. It has been said that every person has his or her own interior master, and that is the monad, our Father who is in heaven. So it is of vital importance that one should hear him when he communicates. These points that I have selected from the accounts given in the occult diary are of course not the only ones, but they are all there is time for now. They are all prefaced by the caution that it is necessary to consider one's involvement with family and other responsibilities, as they may be karmic, therefore needing one's close attention first to ascertain if they have prior rights before changing one's lifestyle. If free to proceed, then as the Master Maurya advises, be careful to keep to the letter any vow, pledge or obligation you may take. He says, disobedience of them poses serious barriers to progress. The Master Maurya continues with the words, when a master looks, in inverted commas, at a potential co-worker, he cannot fail to become aware of any serious, deliberate, and even flagrant indifference to rules and pledges. The unnamed adept carries this a step further when he points out that one must not affirm an occult decision verbally and deny it in some aspect or activity of either physical or mental life. Resolves should be carried out in every department of one's threefold personal life, physical, astral, and mental. Some of you here will be in a position to realize the wisdom of the vow given verbally, with the phrase then added, without mental reservations of any kind. Those still actively Christian will see this wisdom as well in the biblical advice that one cannot serve both God and Mammon, which may be combined with the warning that a house divided against itself shall fall, since the contrary vibrations are bound to shatter it, the vibrations of God being of a totally different wavelength from those of Mammon. Well, friends, we seem to have arrived at a mountain of difficulties. But those brought up in the church should not be surprised, since they have known from childhood the ordinances of the Sermon on the Mount. I have heard people remark to the effect, as I mentioned a little time ago, the rules of conduct set forth there could be only for saints in the becoming, thus not of much relevance for ordinary people. If, however, you compare these pronouncements with those quoted just now from the occult diary, you will discover that there is a certain similarity of intent. For those of the ageless wisdom also refer to the progress of an aspirant from a lower to a higher stage. Geoffrey was inspired to write that, I want to use his own words, discipleship is an intensification of the tests of the probationary period. While this increases the disciple's power for good, it also increases his personal difficulties. His failings and weaknesses become manifest, are apparently magnified. His weaknesses, both active and latent, must be made unmistakably clear to him so that he knows of them and may eliminate them from his nature. This is sound psychology, isn't it? For past faults, through pride or shame, have been suppressed into the unconscious. But to deal with them, the disciple must have them brought to the surface in full consciousness, so that he may perceive in utmost clarity exactly what it is he has to master. Having heard what an aspirant to hastened evolution has to face, you may indeed wonder if there are in the occult diary any words of encouragement. There are indeed. For this is what the Master Nilgiri said to Geoffrey. You are cared for and never alone. Senior aid, suitable to time and need, is ever available. No one ever sincerely and selflessly treads the path, either alone or unobserved. From the Master Maurya also, we have some words of good cheer for those who are having trouble with suppressed faults surfacing. Both time and guidance are ever available for self-purificatory purposes. And if you are having a really tough time and are worried about those annoying lapses, please remember this gem. An individual may be grievously transgressing and still be in the light and within the sanctuary as long as he is fighting. Darkness descends only when he ceases to fight. Let us suppose for a moment that circumstances have permitted you to offer yourself for this truly great and noble task. How do you convey this to a master? Here are the words of the Master Kutumi. No sincere aspirant to spiritual understanding and selfish service is ever overlooked by the great adepts. On the contrary, when the change or the of the Master Kutumi, no sincere aspirant to spiritual understanding and selfless service is ever overlooked by the great adepts. On the contrary, when the change or the idea is sufficiently born and grown within the aspirant, adeptic help is immediately bestowed and retained. And Let me remind you again of what CWL revealed on this subject. It comes in The Masters and the Path. No one can ever be overlooked. And then the Master blended my consciousness with his and raised it to a place far higher than I could reach. And from that elevation, he showed me how the great ones look out upon the world. The whole earth lay before us with all its millions of souls, undeveloped most of them, and therefore inconspicuous. But wherever, amidst all that mighty multitude, there was one who was approaching, even at a great distance, the point at which definite use could be made of him, he stood out among the rest, just as the flame of a lighthouse stands out in the darkness of the night. Now you see, said the Master, how utterly impossible it would be that anyone should be overlooked. I hope you have discovered by this time why I chose Jeffrey's occult diary to be the subject for an evening's lecture. I explained in my first lecture here, after my alleged retirement, that it had stimulated me to return to work. But above and beyond this comparatively trivial incident, the adepts backing its publication have expressed their approval and have watched over its gradual production with some care. The Master Maurya, for example, states, "The diary, apart from its direct personal interest, especially for all who respond to true occultism, also assures the members of the Theosophical Society that we have not deserted the movement." He then asked Jeffrey to make this clear in certain magazine articles he was preparing. I should like to close with some words that are of great importance to us and also summarize my talk. They are from the Master Kutumi. "We have not withdrawn, but remain as much available as ever to those who genuinely climb the golden stairs." That, friends, concludes my talk, but in view of its subject, I hope it will be in order to suggest a slight change here. You have been so kind in the past to applaud at the end of my lecture. But could we this time eliminate the applause and have a minute's silence in which to acknowledge the great ones who have, through Geoffrey Hodgson's book, reasserted their undying regard for our welfare. I will count from now. Thank you. Remember, no applause.